RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Professor Ramesh Thakur is a Brownstone Institute senior scholar, a former United Nations Assistant Secretary General, and Emeritus Professor in the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. And we're getting him on our program this morning to talk about some of the geopolitical issues that we're facing down right now, including NATO, Indo-Pacific, leading on to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and NATO, and even going wider than that, the United States. And of course, we've been putting money into that as well. I think over 100 million so far. And then there's the recent ICJ ruling on Israel, the International Court of Justice. They delivered an advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. So we'll cover off those things. Ramesh, it's great to have you back on RCR Breakfast. I hope you're well.
I'm very good. Thank you, Paul. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm now in the South, and I think you'll relate to where I am because it's really just up the road where you spent quite a bit of time.
Yes, up the road from Dunedin.
Yeah, so I'm getting to know the place. It's beautiful. Everywhere I look, there's a peak. There's snow on those peaks still, which is a big difference from Wellington, where I was before. So that's fantastic.
A lovely part of the world, that.
It sure is. Nature's greatest hits is how I am describing it to people. I don't need to do that for you because you already know. Anyway, it's great to have you back. There's so much to talk about. I'm wondering if I could ask you, and you don't have to answer this, if you don't want to, but do you have any impressions of the opening ceremony of the Paris Olympics?
I've read about the ending. That's an insult to all Christians.
I'm kind of referring to that.
Yeah, well, that was silly. I'm not sure who approved it, but whoever approved it should be fired immediately. I mean, if they want to show courage, I'd like them to do that with regard to Islam religion.
Yeah, well, that's a point that people have been making, that would they have gone there with Islam? And I think the consensus of opinion is, no, they wouldn't have. And maybe
is there anyone who suggests that they would have gone with Islam?
No.
Exactly.
Not that I've seen. Yeah. And that probably
unanimous agreement on that.
Says it all. Yeah, it was quite an experience to watch some of the clips. Anyway, as I say, plenty to talk about. One of the most recent items concerning New Zealand is our Prime Minister's visit to the NATO summit, I guess you'd call it, in Washington, D.C., representing the Indo-Pacific, which is a term that seems to have come into vogue quite recently. Or maybe I'm wrong about that. What do you think?
No, it's relatively recent. It reflects the pivot to the importance of India for Asia-Pacific geopolitical relations and the wish to integrate India into the maritime framework. So it's a logical follow-on from the Quad, which most people don't realize actually has its origins in the Boxing Day tsunami of 2004. Because when that happened, the only four navies that were capable of providing immediate and effective humanitarian relief assistance and disaster relief at the time were Australia, Japan, United States, and India. And the experience of working together raised the comfort level for all four, and they turned it into that. But then the Pacific Command, as it used to be for the United States, was renamed to the Indo-Pacific Command. And it was an effort to bring India into the framework, even absent any formal military alliance that India is not prepared to enter into. So that's what it's all about there.
But we seem to be part of it. And I didn't hear our country mentioned in that list that you just gave
out. No, but the whole region is in the Indo-Pacific, so obviously New Zealand is part of that.
Yeah. But to be involved in NATO being so far away, do you have any thoughts on that? Is that an appropriate association for us?
No. There's a reason NATO is called NATO. It's actually North Atlantic Treaty Organization. If you go back, in fact, to the announcement of AUKUS, whenever that was under Scott Morrison, it's already going back in time.
Yeah.
You have just think of the optics at the time, especially for elderly white European males asserting the right to provide stewardship for the Indo-Pacific region. It was a terrible optic. Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, Scott Morrison. The idea that the Europeans should consider returning to this region, given the history of colonialism, is very off-putting. I don't think NATO has any business extending itself here. I think loose collaboration and cooperation is a different issue. After all, New Zealand is also part of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing arrangement. And the others are involved in NATO. But it throws up all sorts of red flags. And I can see far more downsides. And let me put it this way. I think it's a high risk and low results arrangement. I'm wary of even Australia getting dragged into that, let alone New Zealand. I think we should be careful of that. There's two other considerations. One, at the heart of the NATO alliance is the threat of use of nuclear weapons as a final deterrent. Two, and this is, I want to be careful in phrasing it, not every member of NATO obviously was a colonial power, but every single historical major colonial power from Europe is a member of NATO.
Mm.
And so for most Westerners, NATO signifies a military alliance of the democracies, the major democracies providing the leadership and the others sheltering under that leadership. But to many non-Western eyes, it also symbolizes a not necessarily pleasant episode in our histories. And that has practical consequences as well. And we've seen the split between the West and the vast majority who make up the rest over perceptions of Ukraine, for example. And we've seen that also occurring, although albeit to a lesser extent, with regard to Israel and Gaza. So I think the NATO countries, and in particular, Australia and New Zealand and Japan and possibly South Korea, need to be careful in not drawing too close to NATO, maintaining a distance, and maintaining our right to make our own independent sovereign foreign policy decisions, especially when it comes to getting dragged into entangling military alliances and conflict. And obviously the benchmark there is China.
And I'm thinking of Ukraine because our foreign minister has said some pretty strong things about Russia and its aggression towards Ukraine. Are we at risk of becoming, and this may be a long bow to draw, but some kind of target if things, you know, as they say, cut up rough?
Not with regard to Ukraine, that is, after all, in the European theater. But
if it goes bigger than that, though, Ramesh.
No, but the real danger for us remains China. I don't see New Zealand getting dragged into the military conflict in Ukraine, and I don't see New Zealand or Australia being a target of Russian attacks. On the other hand, if things go belly up and the conflict escalates and crosses the nuclear threshold, then it really doesn't matter where we are located geographically. The consequences of that will encircle the world, and we will not be spared from that. So I think we will be better off using our efforts into encouraging and, if possible, facilitating diplomatic negotiations and solutions. And I think there's been too much of a gung-ho approach and not enough of a willingness to sit down and consider whether, in fact, Russia has any legitimate grievances about the background to what happened in Ukraine, and whether it has legitimate security interests that have to be accommodated, unless our conclusion is that Russia is indeed a militarily defeated power, which clearly it's not. And just as Russia overestimated its military ability vis-a-vis Ukraine in launching what it called the special military operations back in February 2022. Similarly, I think we vastly overestimated our ability to degrade Russia militarily and defeat it. Instead, Russia has adapted far better than we expected, just as Ukraine adapted and resisted Russia far better than the Russians expected. So it's another classic case of how once a war begins, it takes on its own course and it cannot be predicted in advance. And there's all sorts of unintended and perverse consequences that are risked in that as well. And certainly tensions have not ameliorated since February 22, and things are still escalating.
I want to get on to the whole question of the ICJ ruling on Israel shortly, but I just want to spend a bit more time on this. Again, our Prime Minister was up there in Washington, D.C. Only a few weeks ago, it was reported in our media that he had a one-on-one meeting, albeit briefly, with Joe Biden at the time. And he said, and it's almost a quote, I'm paraphrasing, but it's almost a quote, it was across as brief and sharp as you would expect when he met him. Yet here we are 2.5-3 weeks later, and we all know what's happened. And we obviously saw that debate, and that was prior to the meeting with our Prime Minister. It kind of feels like something's not quite right there. that you've sort of got the two poles working against each other of perception anyway. And with what's happened just very recently in the US, and you're talking about China, I mean, who's the more risky party to be associated with in this situation right now, China or the US?
I'm not sure the U.S. is risky at the moment. I mean, look, I haven't seen the exact statement that the New Zealand government or media put out on the Prime Minister's meeting with President Biden. But if it's, as you say, sharp as you'd expect, well, that obviously is a very ambivalent phrase. It depends on what he expected when he went in.
And across his brief, I think, was the other part of that.
Yeah, but again, as per expectation or totally across the brief.
Right.
Gotcha. We know that if you meet President Biden roughly between 10 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, you might still be okay. But unfortunately, world politics doesn't revolve around that particular schedule and timetable of a clearly ailing and cognitively challenged American president. So there will be a window of risk. From our point of view, a window of opportunity from the adversary's point of view, during which they might well decide to test the resolve and the reaction to be encountered. And there's some suggestion, even though I'm linking different issues again, and we'll come back to that. There's some speculation that that might explain the timing of the heightened tensions, even on Israel's northern border vis-a-vis Hezbollah, that it's going to make it difficult for the Americans to respond with robust support for Israel the closer we get to the elections, because there is that very deeply embedded protest now bubbling up in many Western countries, including the United States. So those are different issues. But I think what it shows is not just to the American public, but to the international public, the extent to which we have been gaslit and lied to about the capabilities and mental agility of the American president. And that's bound to have an adverse reputational impact going to the credibility of U.S. foreign policy. So I think they have, again, underestimated how things work out and their capacity to keep this hidden and suppressed was overestimated as well. On the other hand, to be honest, I've been saying to friends, colleagues, since the start of this year, that I didn't think come November, Biden would be the nominee. It's more likely than not that they will sideline him and have someone else. But the way they are operating, they'll keep the whole process tightly controlled. They are unlikely to move into that phase of sidelining him until after the Republican convention has confirmed Donald Trump as their nominee. And then they will move, obviously, before the Democrats' convention. So this was, and the advantage of the strategy, the big advantage of the strategy, is that they avoid a contested Democratic primary, which had the potential to be completely messy and uncontrollable. And this way, the party power brokers get to choose who replaces Biden. And therefore, it's going to be a coronation of Kamala Harris. And that might yet create problems, although at the moment, she certainly seems to be in a political honeymoon period. So I think it is an uncertain moment in terms of the American potential. But I don't, there's nothing to suggest that the Chinese leadership has been irresponsible. They might make mistakes and miscalculate, and they certainly have long-term strategic ambitions, which includes retaking Taiwan and establishing their primacy in East Asia. And that may not necessarily be to our long-term advantage. But I think they've been proceeding cautiously rather than recklessly. And in the case of Ukraine, Russia miscalculated. So all three fronts might see developments that will raise tensions between now and November. And they might want to test, as I said, American resolve and credibility as a guarantor. But I don't think the fact that it's Biden as such, it's clear that there are a lot of senior advisors around him who do have a major say in what happens. Now, of course, he remains president. He does have the ultimate authority, but it's not necessarily all that easy for even the U.S. president to act unilaterally.
When it comes to the Chinese and our relationship with the Chinese, I believe a third of our trade relies on our relationship with China. This term strategic ambiguity, is that how we should be kind of running things?
No, I don't see why you should have strategic ambiguity. I'm obviously still a New Zealand national, but I don't live there and I don't follow New Zealand affairs all that closely anymore. I don't think New Zealand should curtail its trade at the behest of other countries. Whatever New Zealand wants to do, it's in its interest to make its own judgment. And China obviously is a big market and a big growing market. The other big growing market in the future is expected to be India. I think it's always been in New Zealand's interest to diversify its trade relations all around the world, both in regard to imports and exports, reduce dependence on strategic imports from countries that might have problematic elements in the bilateral relationship, make it clear that New Zealand may not be a member of ANZUS in full active standing, but remains part of the Western Alliance, as attested to by the Five Eyes intelligence sharing, as I said, but that it's in New Zealand's interest to try and use its position to mediate and ameliorate tensions rather than make a decision that we are on one side on all matters. I think the difference in the relationship with China compared to the Cold War relationship with the Soviet Union is that it is indeed multidimensional and not just reduced to one broad adversarial relationship on the military side and virtually no contact on the other side. And I think that's in everyone's interest. China is part of the region. China is destined to be the major power in this region. Why would any of us want to get offside with it if we can help it? That doesn't mean that we need to kowtow and appease China. I think we have every right to express our opinions, but it's not in our interest, either Australia or New Zealand, to seek, let alone provoke, any unnecessary and unwanted conflict with China.
So really an independent position is a sensible one, albeit bridging a gap, if we can, to lower the tension if it's needed.
That's right. And within the understanding that if conflict does break out, nonetheless, and it is caused by undesirable actions from the other side, then the chances are high that we will be involved. It's not necessary. I don't see it's in New Zealand's interest to stay right out of it. But that's different from rushing to embrace any conflict, let alone provoking it.
What about involvement in AUKUS Pillar 2, developing and providing advanced military capabilities among US, United Kingdom, Australia, and maybe us? I mean, how would the Chinese interpret a full involvement in that Pillar 2 from New Zealand, do you think?
Again, I would need to be across the details of that from New Zealand's side, which I haven't been. But if it gets too close and integrated for practical purposes, it becomes an AUKUS-adjacent ally, if I may put it like that. And then if there is conflict, then New Zealand does become a direct target. So again, it's a balancing act. And I would really need to be in government or have spoken to them at length and in depth confidentially to be aware of just what is being discussed. Yeah. And how deep the integration is. Pillar 2 obviously doesn't involve the nuclear subs, and that would be in violation of New Zealand law anyway. So it's a question of whether it's marginal issues that is more symbolic than in-depth, but does bring some military and possibly economic benefits to New Zealand, or whether it's deeper than that and is removing for practical purposes autonomous decision making when the things break apart. Those are the questions that I would want to look at if I was still in New Zealand.
Let's move to the Middle East now. The International Court of Justice has delivered, I'm sure you're very aware, the advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, ruling that Israel's occupation is illegal and must end immediately. And they emphasize that Israel's further presence in the territories mentioned is unlawful, and ordered the country to halt all new settlement construction, evacuate settlers, pay reparations to Palestinians for the harm inflicted during the occupation. Israel's having none of it. Where does that put things now? And this is only just in the last 7 or 9 days or so, so very recent.
Well, there's a number of things in that. Firstly, I think we need to separate the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, or the World Court, from the International Criminal Court, the ICC. And the ICC has had its, again, the special prosecutor has requested the ICC judges to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu, for the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, on grounds, various grounds of war crimes. The ICJ, on the other hand, deals essentially most of the time with state-level actions and less so with the criminal side of it, the international criminal law side of it, or international criminal justice. Secondly, this is an advisory opinion at the request of the General Assembly. The General Assembly is empowered to seek such an opinion. I don't think the World Court can refuse to render an advisory opinion. On the other hand, as the name implies, advisory opinion is not legally binding. Third, the fact that they have ruled the Israeli occupation to be illegal is not a surprise. It's consistent with a long-standing majority opinion in the UN community. And that goes back to the fact that, contrary to the public relations messaging from Israel every so often, when they left Gaza in 2005 and Hamas won the election in 2006 and ruled thereafter, they retained control of certain key aspects of affairs in Gaza, including internal affairs and also international affairs. You remember, for example, was it a Norwegian ship that was carrying aid and that was raided by the Israeli Navy, and then being able to close off electricity and internet connections, monitoring communications, controlling borders, various things, etc. And this is why the UN has always described it as occupied Palestine territory. And it has remained as occupied category consistently. On the West Bank, we know that Israeli Jewish settlements have kept expanding. Now, since 1945, the UN has taken the position, and this goes back to the Ukraine issue as well, that no country should be allowed to keep territorial gains from a war anymore. And in a sense, it is a resistance to rewarding Israel with territory gained as a result of the use of force. So the occupation of the territories being illegal is hardly a surprise. And they've taken that a bit further in terms of the current conflict and ruled accordingly. But they don't have any enforcement power. The General Assembly doesn't have any enforcement power. This opinion is not legally binding. It's no more likely to be honored and respected than was the advisory opinion on the legality of nuclear weapons going back to the 80s, which all the nuclear powers have basically just ignored. And that was also an advisory opinion. It adds normative weight and will add to the condemnation by many people around the world of what Israel is doing. But I don't think Israel is going to be swayed one way or the other by it, because as far as Israel is concerned, they are engaged in an existential fight for survival against an enemy that is determined to destroy Israel as the world's only state for Jews and to expel Jews from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. In other words, ethnic cleansing of Jews from the region. And for these reasons, I don't see the Israelis accommodating to the World Court's advisory opinion at all. In their minds, it will just reinforce their view that the UN is, especially certainly the General Assembly, is largely and broadly anti-Israeli. They'll just ignore it. So the critical thing for them is, again, the relationship with the United States.
It could, though, inflame the protest movements in the likes of our country, Australia, and other Western countries, which in some places, you know, it seems to ramp up continually. So there's that. We could see more stoking of local protests on the back of this ruling. Could have that effect.
Well, marginally, I think. It's not going to change opinions on either sides of the divide. Those who are backing Israel, I don't think, going to be persuaded all that much by the advisory opinion. Those who are condemning it, I don't think it will intensify the condemnation or deepen it. It's going to continue. But, you know, I'm skeptical of the continued attention span in Western countries of the protesters. They seem to move from one cause to another each year.
Okay. And that conflict has great potential for spinning out of control, doesn't it?
It seems to be doing so at the moment.
Yeah. And it's sort of through that vortex, pulling in, you know, the likes of Iran and other states as well. Mm-hmm. Is this the, you know, the greatest threat on the face of the planet at the moment in terms of conflict, do you think?
It's one of the greatest.
Okay.
In terms of the international consequences and involvement of other countries, I still think that the greatest threat potentially remains China. And that also has been slowly but surely intensifying and heightening rather than abating vis-a-vis Taiwan. And those incidents continue as well. But in terms of the immediacy of the problem and potential for involvement of other extra-regional powers, yes. Now, having said that, I just don't see Russia and China getting involved militarily in the Middle East. They might have diplomatics, they might offer diplomatic support, but I don't think they're going to risk getting entangled in that. It's in their interest strategically for the Western countries to get entangled, but not for them. It's for them to just stay out and reap the political benefits of the rising anger amongst Arab and Islamic countries, as well as the volatility within the Western countries. On the other hand, Hezbollah is clearly a far more formidable force than Hamas. Mm. It has continued to fire rockets, and the latest one has killed, 11 Israeli youth in northern Israel. in a Druze village. In fact, it's interesting as well. And Hezbollah is closely connected to Iran. We don't know the extent to which Hezbollah takes orders from Iran or acts totally independently of that. We do know that previously Hamas didn't necessarily do what it had been told to do and acted autonomously, and that might even be the military people in Gaza for Hamas in launching the attacks on 7th October last year. And will Iran want to and succeed in reigning in Hezbollah? Or will they, in fact, encourage Hezbollah to continue on this path? Knowing everything we know about Israel, the fact that 11 Israelis have been killed on the Israel side of the border is not going to go unanswered. So this escalation will continue. Now, if you go back to events since 7th October, one of the clear goals of Israel, it's had a multitude of goals since then, obviously to militarily degrade Hamas, to dismantle Hamas as a political power in Gaza, to rescue the hostages, to limit civilian casualties. But one of the additional goals has been, and a major one, to avoid escalation of the conflict. Now, escalation, of course, can be vertical in terms of you start using more weaponry or heavier weaponry or new types of weaponry, or it can be horizontal in that additional actors get sucked into it. With Hezbollah and northern Israel or southern Lebanon, the potential is there for both types of escalation. We've certainly seen vertical escalation since October last year with various attacks, counterattacks, targeted assassinations, rockets being fired, etc. But at some point, the real worry is if Iran gets directly involved, can it stay separate from this? It's going to try, because I don't think it's in Iran's interest to get sucked into it. And it's been very careful and very skilled, actually, at avoiding giving a pretext to be attacked directly. And so that remains the case. And except for that one stage when there was missiles that was fired into Israel, almost all of them, or 98% of them or whatever, got taken down by the Israeli Iron Dome. So I think that remains a worry. And if Iran gets sucked in, does that throw the whole region into turmoil? Quite possibly. And as I said, where does that leave the United States? I think it's going to be difficult if there is a direct war between Iran and Israel for the United States to stay out. On the other hand, for many, many years now, Israel has been trying to get the United States to fight its war against Iran, but not get involved itself. So there's lots of machinations in progress, and how it plays out remains to be seen. But certainly in the immediate future, that is the most worrying concern at the moment. But the consequences of things going wrong for the rest of the world remain higher, both with respect to Ukraine and with respect to China and the South China Sea.
Assuming that it will be a Trump administration come early next year, how do you see that playing out in this conflict? Because I think it's been, it's well known that a certain hawkish element of U.S. administrations have had their eye on Iran for many years. Do you think it depends on who the administration is? And have you got any thoughts as to one or the other and what could come out? Well, of either Kamala Harris, even though we don't know, might ultimately not be her, or a Trump administration and their approach to getting in behind Israel, if it comes to that sort of kinetic conflict.
With Kamala Harris, there's likely to be broad continuity from the existing policy. It will be the same people essentially in charge, mostly, I would think, at the top levels, at the senior levels, as advisors. She's she's prepared to be far more openly critical of Israel with respect to Gaza than almost any other leading political leader, including Biden. But I don't think the policy in terms of supporting Israel against Iran, if the need be, is going to change all that much. With Trump, I think we have to credit him with the fact that he was the first president in a very long time who didn't start another new war, who didn't get involved and was in fact withdrawing, but withdrawing under his conditions. And that element of volatility and unpredictability and his willingness to retaliate with strikes, if challenged, and to strike and assassinate Iranian commander as well, that is by now well known too. So I think there would be a lot more caution in provoking him if he was president. At the same time, we know that if Trump is elected and the vice president is J.D. Vance, now his position is very interesting. He says that Ukraine is a distraction. Europe is wealthy enough and populous enough that it should be able to look after its own security interests. The big strategic game in the near and long-term future for the United States is a rivalry with China, and we need to keep our eye on East Asia rather than Europe. On the other hand, while he's been calling for negotiations to recognize the on-the-ground reality in Ukraine, he's been far more steadfast in his support of Israel than the Biden administration. Now, again, it might depend on who then the other senior advisors and aides are to Trump. I suspect Trump would prefer to focus, if elected in the second term, on being more ruthless in his efforts to drain the Washington swamp and keep a watchful eye on foreign policy. But he's not one who steps back or steps away from a fight if challenged. So yes, there will be volatility. I think there will be more sustained and intense efforts on the part of the Europeans to assume responsibility for their own foreign policy and security. Clearly, they're not big Trump fans, barring a few countries here and there. And I think China will be cautious about essentially a fortress America mentality under America First policies. And in that, Trump and Vance are both aligned with each other. So we'll continue to live in interesting times.
Yeah, as the Chinese say. So that unpredictability of Trump, let's call it that, is actually kind of an asset in a way, because no one is quite on balance. They don't quite know what could happen in any situation. So I have to be a lot more cautious and take more careful steps, let's say.
Yeah. But also, it's the same character trait that we saw on display when he was shot. He got up defiantly with fist pumping, fight, fight, fight.
Yeah. Yeah.
He punches back hard, counter punches. You know, he may not be the first to throw a punch, but if punched, he will throw two punches back and hard. And that certainly seems to be the Vance persona as well.
Professor Ramesh Thakur, fascinating to hear what you had to say. We covered a lot, for our listeners to consider, take away and think about. Nice to chat with you again, and I look forward to another opportunity.
Been a pleasure, Paul. Take care.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.